From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. New LAPD Chief Michael Moore makes his inaugural appearance on Air Talk this hour. Much to talk about, including the tragic deaths of two hostages killed during intense confrontations between suspects and officers. Also, a call by activists to stop using computer modeling to predict crimes. How would that affect the LAPD? Chief Moore with us this hour.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope your day's going well, and always a pleasure to have you with us, whether you tune to the smartphone app, KPCC.org or 89.3. Coming up, LAPD Chief Michael Moore's with us for his first regularly scheduled visit. Many law enforcement topics to consider. But first, California business groups are opposing a number of bills introduced in response to the MeToo hashtag campaign. The groups described the bills as opening the floodgates to lawsuits and being job killers. For example, one bill would ban employers from requiring arbitration to settle sexual harassment claims in lieu of lawsuits. Another would ban non-disclosure agreements. Still another would make alleged harassers personally liable. With us to talk about the series of bills is Capital Public Radio Bureau Chief Ben Adler. Ben, good to have you with us.
It's good to be back, Larry.
So share with us, how many bills are we talking about approximately?
Well, I mean, every lawmaker seems, not every lawmaker, but so many lawmakers seem to have a piece of this in one way or another that any list I give you probably won't be comprehensive. Some lawmaker is going to say, oh, you forgot my bill on this. And there are some other bills that I believe may have gotten through earlier this year. But I'm focused on a handful of bills. My broadcast story has a couple of them. But the web story that's at capradio.org focuses on five of them. And I think of those, the one that would end forced arbitration is probably at the top of the list.
So this would allow someone who's alleging harassment to immediately file a lawsuit instead of going through a private arbitration process?
Yeah. So right now, a lot of employers, as a condition of employment, when you start your job and you sign that giant stack of paperwork, one of the documents that you sign is an agreement to resolve your disputes in arbitration rather than the court system. And it's seen as a condition of employment. And if you don't sign it, well, you know, they might not offer you the job, or they might not let you keep the job if it's done, you know, as a condition for a raise. And so this proposal is to just make it so that you can no longer there can be no retaliation from an employer if an employee chooses not to sign that form. And that's getting a lot of pushback from the business community, simply because the bill as it's written now does not just apply to disputes involving sexual harassment. It applies to any violation of the labor code and any violation of the state Fair Employment and Housing Act, which involves a lot. You know, so we're looking at on the labor code, rest breaks, meal break disputes, sick leave disputes. On the Fair Employment and Housing Act part, there's lots of violations that have nothing to do with sexual harassment. So it could be racial discrimination or gender discrimination or age discrimination, for example, as well.
There's also a bill that would extend the statutes of limitation on filing harassment claims for up to 3 years, and we'll hear why businesses would be opposed to that. But what's the current statute of limitations on filing?
It's 1 year, and so that would increase it to 3 years. And so what you've got to do, if you have a claim that you're filing under the Fair Employment and Housing Act, you file it with a state agency called the Department of Fair Employment and Housing. I think that's the – it's an alphabet soup department, so I may have mangled the acronym a little bit.
We get the idea, though, what they do, yeah.
Exactly. So you file your claim and they process it, and then they can say, okay, this, you know, now that you filed this claim, you know, you've got standing to sue. And we've seen that a little more recently with folks who lost their jobs at the state capitol suing lawmakers or the legislature. And first they go through the state agency, they file their claim, and then they get the green light to file a lawsuit. So right now you've got a year to file that claim. And then this would increase it to 3 years. Now, there is business opposition. I think you might find that businesses are, you know, there's a level of opposition to certain bills. So, for example, the bill to end forced arbitration, the California Chamber of Commerce lists it as one of their job killers. And that list tends to get the attention of a lot of moderates in the legislature and often Governor Brown as well. That is, of the five bills, that's the one that really makes it on the job killer list. Another bill was on there too, but a clause is being taken out that is going to take it off the list. So the other bills Cal Chamber opposes, but I guess you could say to a lesser extent.
All right. There is a bill that would ban non-disclosure agreements. Now, that's kind of a staple of many industries in the state. The entertainment industry uses that's a norm of business because of the damage bad publicity can have. How far would this bill go?
So it would ban the use of non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment, assault, and discrimination cases. And you're talking about even when there's, you know, something negotiated as part of a severance package. Now, this is different from a non-disparagement clause, and there's another bill that deals with that doesn't apply to severance cases that we can talk about next if you'd like. But this specifically is about the banning of the non-disclosure agreements. And, yeah, I mean, that was a pretty typical one with all of the, you know, the Harvey Weinstein cases and agreements that were signed. And has happened a lot at the state capitol, too, which got a lot of attention. Is lawmakers who left the legislature, or sorry, lawmakers, staffers who left the legislature and had made some accusations, they would often settle and there would be a non-disclosure clause. So they wouldn't be able to talk about it.
Okay.
Yes,
so,
yes.
So you couldn't have and non-disparagement, when does that come into play?
So non-disclosure is you can't talk about an incident. Non-disparagement is you can't say that your employer sucked. Basically, or you can't speak negatively about your employer. That's the non-disparagement. Or if it's an agreement with an individual, Harvey Weinstein, you wouldn't be able to speak negatively about Harvey Weinstein. So that's the non-disparagement. Now, the non-disparagement bill, this is a SB 1300 by Senator Hannah Beth Jackson, would prohibit employers from requiring workers to sign away two rights as a condition of employment or receiving a raise. One is the non-disparagement agreement. And the other is a document called a release of claims. And so that's something you would file saying, I release any right to sue or even file a complaint. I'm releasing a right to file a claim against you if you wrong me. Now, again, this bill only applies at the start of the process, prospectively, or rather, you know, as a condition of employment or getting a raise. Both of those things that we're talking about, non-disparagement agreements and releasing claims, those are pretty signature staples of settlements. So settlements or severance packages. So let's say that an employee is fired. They might, as a condition of getting severance pay, be asked to sign agreements waiving your right to sue and waiving your right to criticize. That, my understanding is, would remain legal if this bill we're talking about, SB 1300, passes. It only covers ending those, you know, banning workers from being required to sign those two documents as a condition of employment or receiving a raise. Companies could still put that on the table for severance packages.
Ben, thank you so much for walking us through these bills. We really appreciate it. Know you're on deadline. We'll let you go. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, no problem. Have a good show.
Thanks. Capital Public Radio's Bureau Chief Ben Adler joining us from Sacramento. Also with us is Wendy Musell, who's an employment and civil rights attorney. She's the chair of the California Employment Lawyers Association Board. Ms. Musell, thank you for being with us.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So first of all, what's your response to concerns of the business community that these are going to be costly for businesses to implement?
I think that that concern is way overblown. If we take the forced arbitration bill, or supposed forced arbitration, really what this bill does is gives workers a choice. If they wish to go to arbitration, they certainly can do so. But it allows them the choice to say, would I like any issue that happens, violations of civil rights, sexual harassment, sexual assault, to be adjudicated in a private forum, which wouldn't see the light of day and the public wouldn't know about what happened in that forum? Or would I like to exercise my constitutional right to a jury? It simply is about choice and about not being retaliated against if an employee says, you know what, I'd like to retain my legal rights and my constitutional rights, and I shouldn't have to give that up simply for coming to work.
All right. Let me bring into the conversation Sue Ben-David, who is chair of the Employment Law Department at Encino-based Lewitt Hackman. She represents companies and managers who are alleged to have committed sexual harassment. Ms. Ben-David, thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. So let's sort of take these briefly one by one. First of all, what do you see as the harm in removing the ability of companies to have mandatory arbitration?
Well, it's not that the employees are being declined the ability to pursue their claims. The only difference is, what is the jurisdiction? Where is that claim going to be heard? And our Supreme Court has already opined, the U.S. Supreme Court has already opined, that employers are legally entitled to have matters heard in a private jurisdiction before an arbitrator. That's the only distinction, is here that it will be in a private context with an arbitrator, not that their claims will not be heard at all. And the employer has to pay for it, so there's no expense to the employee. So as far as my clients are concerned and employers are concerned, they do think it's important that they have the right to pursue these claims privately and not in the public.
How much input do plaintiffs have, the employees have, in the choice of the arbitrator?
It's by mutual agreement between the parties. And if the parties can't agree, then there are procedures that are followed. So, for example, if you use there's arbitration companies, if the parties can't agree on a mutually agreeable arbitrator, there's a process that's in place so that there is a neutral arbitrator that is selected.
Okay. And also wanted to ask you about the statute of limitations for filing of a claim being extended from 1 year to three. What is the problem for a company in terms of defending over that longer period?
Right. I think everybody might anticipate that, you know, when 3 years have lapsed and suddenly now a new claim has come to light, memories are going to fade and witnesses are not going to be around. And I'm dealing with this every day. We have claims that are filed. And when you sit somebody down in a room and you say, what exactly did he or she say to you 2.5, 3 years ago? People don't remember. And these are very fact-specific claims. And the employer community is of the mindset that if there is a claim that has happened to you, then 1 year, within that 1 year period, that would seem to be a sufficient period of time that if you felt your rights were violated, that's the time to file the claim so that witnesses can be spoken with, documents can be gathered, information can be reviewed, and if there's a violation, then it can be resolved accordingly.
Also, the bill that would ban non-disclosure agreements, the criticism here, we've heard a lot of it in the wake of Me Too allegations, that any patterns that existed with particular employees or how companies have dealt with it never made it to light, so that could be addressed. Everybody just had to take an individual discharging of their legal action. What's a better way to get at this so that these events don't occur in darkness and no one who is victimized, you know, can find out it's happened to someone else?
I think it's interesting that, as a matter of fact, today I'm going to a mediation, and I'm representing a client who's been accused of sexual harassment, and he is vehemently opposed to the claims. He said, I did not do anything of the nature, and the only reason we're going to mediation is because of the cost of litigation. So if we resolve the claim today, it's because of the cost, not because of any admission of liability and not because he did anything wrong, but because if the if the matter goes to trial and it takes 3 years to litigate and all that time and expense and attorney fees and costs, the vast majority of these claims are resolved and a large number of my clients haven't done anything wrong. So you have people who are on the defense saying, why am I being accused of something that I did not do? This is not the Harvey Weinstein situation, clearly. This is a case where people that I represent are saying, I didn't do anything wrong, and my reputation has now been damaged in this public filing. And at the very least, I don't want this to be spread to anyone else because I've been harmed.
Couldn't your client, though, turn around and sue the accuser after the arbitration process is done?
If it's resolved in a settlement, that's where the non-disclosures come up. And if it's resolved in a settlement, then no, there would be no post-settlement lawsuit against the plaintiff. And
okay.
The reality is that there are legal restrictions against suing the plaintiff for pursuing legal claims. There's some legal.
Well, so let's take a hypothetical. The case you describe, so your client goes to arbitration, some settlement is reached, and I'm sorry, yeah, okay, mediated terms, and then the accuser in this case, goes public. Couldn't your client still turn around and sue that individual? Or would the arbitrated terms preclude that?
Well, if there's a non-disclosure in the settlement agreement.
No, I'm saying without a non-disclosure. I'm saying if this law passed, they couldn't do a non-disclosure.
No, then the employee who sued could say, I sued this person, I got all this money, and here's what I sued him for. And those would all be true statements because the person did, in fact, sue. So it wouldn't be defamation. And so the harm to the client is very real. Because he said, I did not do anything. No way, shape, or form did I harass this person.
So without a non-disclosure, it would force him to defend in a trial, you're saying?
Yeah, and then it could be longer and more expensive and costly. And anyone who's a defense attorney knows how expensive it is to defend these claims.
Wendy Musel, you want to respond to that?
Absolutely. Regarding the statute of limitations issues, this is simply keeping the statute of limitations in line with other lawsuits. For example, personal injury is 2 years statute of limitations, fraud is 3 years, contract disputes are 4-year time frame. So this is simply keeping it in line with other statute of limitations, and victims of harassment and discrimination may need additional time and have additional barriers because of trauma, lack of awareness of their rights, or needing to become financially secure before coming forward. As it relates to the omnibus bill, which allows clarification of what the law is for sexual harassment, this is really geared to address different jobs, different justice, or getting a different result in different courts. So this provides clarification in the workplace for employers and employees about what sexual harassment is. In terms of the non-disparagement, these are really sneaky releases. If you can imagine getting a 50-cent raise, a dollar raise, and suddenly, without you knowing, you are signing away your legal rights and signing away your ability to say, hey, wait a minute, there's illegal conduct happening in the workplace. I see people being sexually harassed. Perhaps they're not being paid accurately. And these are not allowing those sort of sneaky releases from finding their way into your employment. And it does not in any way prohibit a settlement agreement, which may include agreements about non-disparagement at the end of the day. But we've seen how destructive those.
I need to break off. Wendy Musel, thank you so much. Sue Ben-David, we appreciate your both being with us. You can share your comments about these series of bills that have been introduced in Sacramento in response to the Me Too hashtag movement. It's Air Talk on 89.3. Coming up next, in his first visit, a regular guest with us, Chief Michael Moore of the LAPD, who's recently taken the office. We'll be back with conversation with him in 1 minute. Great to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We welcome to the studio the new chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, Michael Moore. Succeeds Charlie Beck, who during his years in office joined us regularly on the program to talk about issues not just within his department, but within law enforcement generally. If you have questions for Chief Moore, you can put them on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. You can tweet at AirTalk or call 866-893-KPCC. Chief Moore, welcome. Great to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry. It's great to be here.
Just first, very, very basic question. How's it feel to be the chief just a few weeks into this job?
I'm enjoying a tremendous opportunity. This is a opportunity of a lifetime that I never envisioned I'd be, that I would hold, but I'm enjoying every moment of it.
Share just briefly your background with the department, how many years you've been in law enforcement, specifically LAPD.
Well, my entire career has been with LAPD and law enforcement, my entire adult life in reality. This is my 37th year. Came up through the ranks as a young patrol officer working in various parts of the city and then made detective, sergeant, lieutenant. Seen many milestones within the city. The city changed over the past 37 years, I believe much for the better, as well as for LAPD. And yet I see so many opportunities that are still out there.
And you grew up here in L.A.?
No, I actually grew up all throughout the United States. I was born in the Central Valley of California and lived in Southern California, Northern California, Michigan. Went to high school during my high school years in Arkansas. So I've moved around quite a bit, but landed back in Southern California in the late 70s and joined the department in 1981, and I've been in Angeleno since. I live just outside our boundaries, but I'm moving into the city this year.
All right. Very good. Chief Michael Moore with us on Air Talk. I want to begin with two tragic incidents in which hostages in intense confrontations were shot and killed by officer fire, the Trader Joe's hostage-taking incident in Silver Lake. You had another incident that occurred within days of that. Just update us on where the department is in investigating those incidents.
Well, as you indicated, it's just two terrible circumstances that officers were thrust into. In the first incident, this was an individual who was in Van Nuys at a homeless service center and attempted to stab his girlfriend. And then later, when confronted by officers, took a hostage. And unfortunately, in the officer's efforts to gain her safety, their gunfire, two of the rounds actually struck her, and we lost her. That investigation continues in bringing to light the circumstances, a better understanding. We, of course, went out and provided the public the first look at our body-worn video and digital in-car video in the context of how that tragic incident unfolded. Similarly, regarding the Trader Joe's incident, where officers were in pursuit of an individual who had shot his grandmother numerous times and then actually struck his girlfriend as well with one of those gunfire rounds and then took her hostage. As officers attempted to arrest him, he fled into the Trader Joe market and was firing rounds at us, at the pursuing officers. And in the officers' returning fire, one of those rounds struck the store manager there, and unfortunately, we lost her, Ms. Corrado. That investigation as well, there's many layers of this in the sense of the forensic investigation of the crime scene, statements of witnesses, including those of the officers. Pulling all that together into a completed investigation is still months out. I've not made a determination on the actions of either one of those instances beyond the fact that we did go out last week and make announcements relative to changing in our training. And that was taken in part because of things that I saw, particularly in the Van Nuys incident, but also in looking at our use of force, particularly deadly force, in 2017, and the frequency in which the number of officers seemingly increased, relying on deadly force as a force option, but also in the impact that our less lethal, our beanbag shotguns and tasers, were having, in order to overcome the resistance or to gain control of the circumstance. I encourage the public to go online, to LAPD Online, where we are posting now videos within 45 days, critical incidences involving officer-involved shootings with what we have and what we know today. And relative to this issue about this training change this last week, and also the addition of additional less lethal weapons, is in relationship to seeing the impact of our beanbag shotgun not having desired impact.
Oh, okay. And we'll talk a little bit also about the change in policy to a 14-day cooling off period, whatever you want to call it, where an officer involved in a shooting causing injury or death is taken off the job. But I want to go back to the Trader Joe incident because, I mean, this is so sad. The manager of the store, clearly out of concern for customers and sense of responsibility, goes to check and to see what the threat is and is killed. At the same time, officers are undoubtedly very aware of what it means for this suspect to get into that market and the threat that that entails. And I wonder if you can speak to that, because, I mean, this is a terrible decision for an officer to have to make in the heat of the moment.
Absolutely. It's a decision that none of us would ever want to have to be to make that decision, to be called to make that decision. But yet, it's one that we realize in this profession that we must provide the training and the tools, hire wisely, intelligent people who have the ability to work through dynamic situations quickly and work upon their values to try to come up with a best solution. In this instance, this gunman had fired on the officers repeatedly over the course of the vehicle pursuit, had a hostage inside of the vehicle, and then, as you indicated, crashed his vehicle and then began running into a store full of people. And the officers had mere seconds in order to determine what his motivations were, what his potential, what level of harm or what level of death he could further instill upon that scene. And they acted and they relied on their training and they fired their weapons to officers in an effort to stop him. What they didn't know was with an armed gunman is whether he'd go into that store and continue in the shooting spree, this terrible onslaught of violence that he had just enacted upon his grandmother and upon this hostage in his vehicle. And yet the officers have in their background an awareness that such instances do occur and that it's and yet as they're making a decision, can they stop him by utilizing gunfire while minimizing the risk to others? They've got to balance that. Yeah. And as our efforts in coming to the public and showing the context of this was not to pass judgment on it, but was to share, if you will, with Angelenos these type of trying circumstances that officers sometimes find themselves in.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, the person didn't harm the suspects inside, but you have no way of doing that. And in fact, he did take control over them and didn't allow them to leave.
Well, exactly. He not only took them as hostage and threatened to shoot and kill them, he continued to shoot out of the store at the officers who were surrounding the store. And you know, I'm so thankful that the customers, the Trader Joe employees themselves, and our people were able to work through this scenario, through crisis negotiation, through the use of our psychologists that were on scene to eventually convince him to surrender peacefully. But we have seen, unfortunately, not only in this country but across the world, circumstances that did not turn out as peaceful as this one did.
Yeah, very impressive what the customers in the store did in playing their part in bringing that to a close.
Certainly a sacrifice that they were willing to make and proud of their ability to accomplish that.
We're talking with new LAPD Chief Michael Moore with us on Air Talk. You can post questions on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org, or join us at 866-893-KPECC or tweet at Air Talk. So I want to talk about this new policy that instead of 72 hours for an officer involved in an injurious or fatal shooting being off the job, that being extended to a 14-day period. What's the necessity of that? I mean, particularly if you've got a shooting where the injury is minor.
Well, it's the use of deadly force by an officer is the most critical decision that an officer can make. And in such an incident, the dynamics of not just once they make that decision, but the outcome has an absolute immediate effect on the officer. as well as it can have a lasting effect over the course of their career. It's a traumatic event. It's a very dramatic event. And it's one that historically, for decades, we have involved our psychologists from our behavioral service science sections to sit down and debrief officers to normalize, if you will, their emotions and their processing of such a traumatic event, and to monitor them to see how they are coping. What's their how is their resilience in the face of this incident? Historically, we have looked at that period. That initial session occurred within usually 2 to 3 days after the event, allowing the officer a couple sleep cycles to get some rest and collect their thoughts, and then to describe in a confidential setting, a setting that, by the way, as chief, I do not have info as to what is shared. But that psychologist can help afford them the means of processing through that event. What we looked at is in the last couple years, we began looking at is that decision then of once that session occurs, is that sufficient? And what we came back in looking at the field of study and agencies across the country and talking with academia as well as with the psychology field is we've determined that we need to have more sessions, not just sessions that the officer was always allowed to ask for and engage in, but we need to come back and check with that officer months after this event to see how they're doing. In that process also was this 72-hour notion that an officer would be pulled from the field and would not be allowed to work the field because they'd just been exposed to this traumatic event. If we want to re-expose
them,
they could walk out tomorrow and be faced with a similar or same circumstances and be asked again to make that critical decision. We want to give a little time and distance from that. And what we found was that why not extend that to a longer period of time to allow the officer more time to recover, to collect themselves, and the assurance that they would not be thrust back into a situation again and called to make a similar life-death decision with only moments of consideration. So that's where we now have at least a 14-day period in which the officer will remain out of the field in either administrative assignment or special detail, and then I'll make a determination based on the feedback and also an understanding of what occurred of whether or not it's appropriate at that time for an officer to be put back, if you will, in the field to face new challenges.
We'll continue our conversation with Chief Moore on Air Talk. We'll be back right after this live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. New LAPD Chief Michael Moore is with us talking about issues in law enforcement. First of his regularly scheduled visits as he takes the baton from former Chief Charlie Beck. Let me ask a listener question about scooters. David in Fairfax says, what is LAPD going to do about the safety hazard of scooters?
So I'm encouraged that the city council is now acting on their evaluation of whether or not those scooters have even a role or a place in Los Angeles. And it may be that there's portions of Los Angeles that form of transportation is more readily viable or acceptable than others. However, there's existing state law in regards to the conduct of those individuals on those scooters, and we're involved in an outreach campaign, an education campaign, reminding people who operate those scooters about the law, about helmets, the use of vehicles on sidewalks, and the dangers that they represent, not only to the operator, but to pedestrians and motorists. I'm very concerned. This is one of those emerging technologies, and as it comes out, that the rest of the community is not well prepared. And there's a responsibility of the manufacturers and those companies that operate these vehicles to ensure that they're operating in a manner that is going to afford the safety, not only of the people operating the scooters, but the surrounding public. I'm down in Pacific or Venice Beach area just last week. We did some education, outreach, and engagement along people along the boardwalk because a number of these scooters have found themselves there. And operators, tourists, people who are coming from outside the region see them and they think, I can use these and I can use them on the boardwalk when, in fact, they can't. And while the posted signs are there, they're seeing a rush of others using those studios.
It must be okay.
And so we're going to seek compliance, and we're going to achieve it, not just through a heavy hand of enforcement. We want to have a balancing act of informing the public, act responsibly, if they act responsibly on roadways with helmets, obeying the traffic laws, I think they can be a safe and efficient means of moving about this city.
Well, that's something we've heard a lot because we've done many segments on this topic of the scooters. And one of the things that we've heard from both supporters of the scooters and opponents is about a lack of enforcement. And so they've said, you know, there are laws. People are just flagrantly flouting those laws either because they don't know or because they don't care, and that there's really no one there to rein in that behavior. So at some point, does this switch from education to an enforcement citation model?
Well, that switch is already there. And so those that believe that LAPD is not taking enforcement action, I would differ. I know that our men and women are out there and are both educating and, when appropriate, taking enforcement action, including the issuance of a citation. I think the issue for me is that this is a shared responsibility of how this new item is brought into a community and how the people who provide those vehicles are exercising responsibly as those purveyors. I mean, how are they informing the people who are going to gain access to that of what the laws are and how they should be operating?
So you don't have to educate everybody. It should be that the company that's renting the scooters, they're providing
this
that.
Is a commercial endeavor. This is a matter – I think the challenges with this is it's a commercial endeavor, and yet these vehicles are being left all about. They're cluttering our roadways and sidewalks and thoroughfares, and the people who provide these as a commercial endeavor need to act responsibly just as everyone else does. And it should not be a free-for-all.
Wanted to ask you a separate topic. Activists have said that computer modeling, so-called predictive policing, which has been a significant part of LAPD's law enforcement efforts, that enables racial profiling and that it is inherently discriminatory to use that technology in the way that it's used. CompStat and predictive policing has been credited with significantly cutting crime in Los Angeles. What's your response to the claim of activists?
Well, I believe that data-driven, data-informed policing is right. Policing is a very labor and personnel-intensive activity. And as we look to understand where crime and how crime is occurring, collecting data points of that is part of our bread and butter of our work. What has come in the last decade has been this analysis of, does that data analysis, are there artificial intelligence or algorithms that can identify and predict where the next crime will occur? Humans, we're species of habit. And so as an individual goes out and commits crime, we do find, and the literature does support, that there is a habit. There's a serial fashion in which people operate. Can our data systems pick up those patterns in conduct, and can we interrupt them by either having have an officer there or have an officer identify the person who's committing those crimes by virtue of that habit and take enforcement, make an arrest, stop it from occurring? The critics today believe in some part, and I'm very much a willing and listening ear to this, is that the data that we're talking about can be biased because of race or ethnicity. And that because of that bias of that data, that the resulting enforcement action is therefore biased. And so the machine itself isn't biased. It's just that built or cooked into the algorithm is this racial bias. So we are very much in concert with the Commission and Inspector General's office and those critics to look and honestly evaluate those claims. It is important to us that in policing, that the public trust us, that our efforts are sincere and genuine in keeping and affording the safety of everyone in Los Angeles. We want to make sure our systems that we use respect the civil rights of everyone involved and also protect against unconscious bias.
The challenge, of course, is that crime tracks with income levels, and income levels has correlates that go with racial and ethnic composition that relates to income. So how do you avoid the results ending up with what's a de facto, you know, lower income neighborhoods being the focus where you've got more residents of color and therefore they end up with, you know, more attention?
That's the complexity of the problem. The correlation does not necessarily mean causation. It's an old adage, and yet it's very relevant here today. What I believe is the more we can talk openly about what our data points are, what our information is as to where crime is occurring and the described suspects that are committing those crimes and how we then go out to identify those described individuals to stop them from committing continued crimes, that the more that is discussed, the more that people believe that this is not some magic or invisible hand directing officers is to our betterment and to improves the conversation. And it's upon my responsibility to ensure that people, that our communities that we serve understand that we're not predicting that Larry is about to go out and commit a crime. What we're looking at is in the background of you or someone else, have you committed violent offenses, violent crimes in the past? And if you have, are you under probation or under supervision today? And if you are, does your description match the description of a gunman who just committed a street robbery? And if it does, is it fair for us to look and suspect that Larry's involved in that crime? I believe that's a rational and reasonable approach. There are others who would believe that the description of who committed that street crime was biased, or that the enforcement against this particular crime outweighs the enforcement that we take against other crimes that are occurring in other parts of the city. At the end of the day, as a chief, I'm going to talk openly and honestly with everyone in our communities. Our first order of business is violent crime, and that in this regards, predictive policing or laser or these systems, to the extent that they help inform us how to lower violence, is where, and while protecting the rights of everyone involved, is where we will pursue the use of those tools.
We'll continue our conversation with LAPD Chief Michael Moore. It's his inaugural visit with us on Air Talk. Yesterday, he talked about openness to reforming a program designed to keep officers and administrators on the job longer with a retirement enhancement. We'll talk about what kinds of reforms there might be to the DROP program. And we'll also talk about another proposal involving bench warrants for the homeless. Chief supporting their dismissal of those. We'll continue in just 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle, LAPD Chief Michael Moore with us. The Los Angeles Times a couple of days ago published a story about Chief Moore before he became chief, taking a $1.25 million payout under the DROP program. This was designed as a 5-year incentive to keep those on the job who might have otherwise retired, allow them to collect both their salary as well as the pension that they would have received over that 5-year period of time. But that program is now being criticized because of the expense. Number of other police departments around the country that implemented similar programs have dropped them as well because of the cost associated. So, Chief, this was a very nice payout for you under this incentive to keep you on the job. And then you were rehired. You came back to the department after that. What do you think needs to be changed in DROP?
Well, first, I think a good conversation about the deferred retirement option program should be made relative to its cost neutrality. This program in its design in Los Angeles has been different than it has been designed in other cities across the state and across the country. And I believe that when it was designed initially, that its controls relative to showing its cost neutrality has proven out, with some exception. The reality of that, an officer, our ability to retain a senior officer so that and having them continue versus them otherwise leave the force, something I experienced and something that we have hundreds of personnel in our department who could leave tomorrow. But with the presence of DROP, they're incentivized to stay. And that helps me with retention and helps me keep staffing at the levels that I need for the policing in Los Angeles. But it needs to be cost neutral, and the public needs to have faith and confidence that it's not being abused. The cost neutrality is something that is being looked at yet again. Are the officers' pensions that would otherwise go to the officer, are they funding this account, or is the public having to reach into its pocket more and add additional monies? So is it cost neutral or not? Secondly, is it being abused? And in this instance, I'm particularly interested, as Chief Beck was, and I know as our city the city elected leadership is. We've had some instances where officers who we've meant to retain by drop have entered into the program and then suffered an injury where they've been absent from work for an extended period of time, months or years. And so at in effect, the desire of why drop was initiated hasn't been accomplished. And we need to change that because it undermines the confidence in the system and jeopardizes my ability to have an important tool to retain employees that that keep the service levels in Los Angeles high.
Could you legally, for any of the officers who leave because of injury, remove that as part of the five-year time credited toward the lump sum retirement payment, the pension payment? Could you exclude that period, or would that not work legally?
Well, that's exact. That is what the question is, and I believe that's what our elected officials and City Hall is working through now with representatives of our Los Angeles Police Protective League as well as our Command Officer Association, is what legally can we do with a person who's vested in their pension is now, and officially when you go into drop, you retire. I mean, you are no longer, you no longer have all the benefits of an active employee, and you have a date certain that you can only stay until then you must leave. And during that period of time when you would otherwise receive your pension check, it's put into a separate account that has to be cost neutral to the city. Many of these employees continue to actually pay into the retirement program during that time. But the challenge with this is if we're going to now do a timeout, you've left because of a knee injury or you suffered a back injury, because this is a job that has significant demands on people. Now you can no longer come to work. Should you be allowed to collect that drop deferred retirement payment in addition to your normal salary? And I believe that we have some very sharp minds and people that recognize the need to build confidence in this program that are going at it full bore. And I believe that our senior representatives within the league and our labor units recognize that the need for this as well.
Well, and if you can't legally exclude those periods of injury, then can you really keep the drop program going, given the cost that you're paying all this money, people aren't even able to work?
I think that you have a very valid point. Is the program's impact today, I can tell you, both personally as well as a chief and a senior executive. When this program first started, many of our employees would leave with 25 to 30 years on the job. And they would retire, and they'd enjoy their retirement, and they'd go on to another profession. We'd find
them security work.
Or be a police chief someplace else. They're relatively young in today's day and age, and they took on new challenges, new opportunities. By us putting this program in place, we were able to retain them for an additional 5 years. And we see today regularly the vast majority of people in drop in the police side. Now, the fire has a little different experience, but on the police side, the vast majority are working. They're full duty. They're employed. They're giving us what we asked for, which is an extended amount of their time. And they're doing it in a manner that doesn't cost the city any additional funds and allows me the benefit of not having to retrain and replace them. If we can't accomplish that because people are able to game the system where they take an injury and now they're gone for a year, two, three, 4 years, then I understand your point.
All right. Thank you so much, Chief Moore. Appreciate your being with us. We'll look forward to talking with you again soon on the program.
Very good. Thank you.
Michael Moore, his inaugural visit on Air Talk, the new chief of the Los Angeles Police Department. Coming up in our second hour of Air Talk, we're going to take a look at the Harvey Weinstein case and a civil lawsuit, a very important federal decision yesterday.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, helping businesses improve their bottom line with solar water heating. The system preheats your water using the strength of the sun. It works with your existing natural gas water heater to warm your water in a reliable and efficient way. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover up to 80% of the system's cost. With these rebates, heating water with the sun could be a sound investment. It's the strength of the sun in your business. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Such pleasure to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up later this hour, Crazy Rich Asians opens today, a film that isn't just important because a major studio film that is tracking to do well at the box office for a romantic comedy, but also it's all Asian cast. And in areas with large Asian American populations, theaters preparing for a lot of crowds to come out and see the film over the coming days. We're going to talk about the business side of Crazy Rich Asians, what the release pattern for the film is, expected box office, and we're also going to open up the phones for those who've had a chance to see the film or are planning to, what it means particularly for Asian American listeners of Air Talk. But first, we turn our attention to a federal court judge's decision yesterday. It involves a lawsuit filed against Harvey Weinstein under federal circumstances for sex trafficking laws. And the New York-based judge ruled that the plaintiff in the case can sue Weinstein for violating sex trafficking laws because the proverbial casting couch is essentially commercial sex. That's what the judge said. So this lawsuit can proceed on those terms. Harvey Weinstein's attorney argued that this essentially would open up the door for lawsuits to follow any sorts of sexual activity where one person has something potentially the other person would want or there is a power differential. Joining us to talk about the legal precedent here and the significance of the judge's decision is Vince Finaldi, senior attorney at Manley Stewart & Finaldi, a law firm which represents alleged victims of sexual abuse. Mr. Finaldi, thank you for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
So how important is the judge's decision in this case?
Well, yeah, I don't know that it's all that important at this point in time. It's going to be, as Lefta said, how important it's going to be, when we see what happens with the case. Obviously, this is early on in the litigation. So right now, the only thing the court said is that you've got enough to proceed with that cause of action. Whether or not they're actually successful on it is another story. And then going further from there, whether it passes scrutiny by an appellate court or a higher court is another issue. You know, that's something that would be needed to create any kind of precedent that would apply to future cases. So right now, we really don't know how that's going to pan out. It's really going to be a fact-driven analysis, and it's going to depend largely on the facts of the case, all of which are not really made public as of this point in time.
And as unsavory as a quid pro quo casting couch scenario is, I think for many of us, we hadn't assumed that that was illegal, that there are all kinds of other, obviously, ethical and employment law and other. But in terms of it potentially being illegal, not necessarily so. Does in the judge saying this, I know we're talking about a civil case, yeah, but if it's sex commerce we're talking about, does that potentially mean that someone could be prosecuted for a casting couch scenario?
Absolutely. And, you know, to get back to your point before that, this is just a different flavor on something that we've known for a long time. Sexual harassment, you know, includes casting couch interviews. It always has. It usually has to be done in the employment setting, but there's always been liability for casting couch type behavior. It's not the power differential that's the problem. It's using that power differential coercively or fraudulently. That's where the hook is for the sexual harassment. And, you know, so here, if someone is engaging in that type of conduct and it's through interstate commerce, then yeah, that could put them on a hook for sex trafficking as the statutes are written. However, I'd like to point out that this is a case of first impression. That's something that the court pointed out as well. So what we do is, you know, the legislature creates the laws. And what we see is, through the courts, through cases, sometimes the laws are tested to see what the bounds are, to see if something applies. And I think, you know, under the black letter of the law, I think this scenario definitely would apply. Whether courts agree or not is still left to be said.
We're talking with Vince Finaldi, who's a law specialist representing alleged victims of sexual abuse at the firm Manley Stewart and Finaldi. Also with us is distinguished professor of law at Rutgers University, New Jersey, Stuart Green. He has written about commercial sex under the law. Professor Green, thank you for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
So what do you think of the judge's decision in this, allowing it to proceed under the classification of commercial sex trafficking?
Well, it's a careful decision, and it is a question of first impression, as Vince said, and it doesn't assume any actually assumes the facts as alleged. It doesn't require that the plaintiff at this point prove any of those facts. So it really is an early stage decision. I think the statute under which the plaintiff is suing is extraordinarily broad in its language, and I think there's a reasonable case, and I think the judge made that case, that the statute on the books is probably broad enough to include the conduct that's alleged. Whether that's a good idea, whether Congress should have written such a broad statute, is another question.
And I was wondering, too, what the implications are for the plaintiff, because if it is alleged that this is a sex trafficking issue, to where the plaintiff alleges she comes to Harvey Weinstein's hotel room at the Cannes Film Festival to show her reel to him. He then engages in sexual conduct in her presence, to which she's an unwilling party. Does this potentially open up her to Weinstein's attorney saying, well, if this is considered to be a sexual transaction, she knows his reputation, they might argue, comes to his room, and then it ends up, that strategy ends up backfiring. Is that a possibility?
Well, in theory, yes, but in practice, no. The conduct that's alleged actually occurred in Cannes at near the film festival, and I think also in London some of the conduct occurred. So one of the strange things about this statute is that it has a very broad extraterritorial application, since it involves a U.S. national. Even though the conduct occurred abroad, the federal statute sort of reaches out and covers that. But in terms of her, say, being prosecuted for a sex work or prostitution offense in the United States, it's hard to see how that would happen since there aren't any contacts. But suppose it did. I mean, suppose that it occurred in New York or in Los Angeles, it's a good question whether her admission in the complaint that she essentially complied with Weinstein because she hoped, you know, to get what he was offering or possibly could offer to her. Yes, I mean, in most jurisdictions in the U.S., we hold liable not only the person who buys the sex, but also the person who is offering to sell the sex. That's not true in so much in Europe, but in the U.S., both sides of the transaction are subject to criminal penalties. And so, interestingly, you know, she could, I think, in some jurisdictions, given that admission, she could be prosecuted for selling sex, as it were, under prostitution statute.
We're talking with law professor, Rutgers University, Stuart Green. Is there a distinction under this statute between coercive threats? I mean, the behavior that's been alleged by Weinstein, by, you know, so many of the women here, is threats are involved, retaliatory measures, those sorts of things, versus an exploitive offer, so to speak. I mean, is there a distinction to be made?
Right. So, I mean, I think most people would say that there is. It's one thing to say, I will, you know, I agree to have sex with you if you put me in your film. That's an offer that's being made. You're hoping that you'll be treated better off than you maybe deserve to be, as opposed to a producer saying, I'm going to make sure that you never work in this town again unless you have sex with me. That's a threat, and it threatens to make the person who is being threatened worse off than she deserves to be. That's sort of the distinction that, you know, philosophers would make between threats and offers. in practice, sometimes it's hard to distinguish exactly where that line exists. Interestingly, though, this statute doesn't actually use the term coercion or threat. It talks about fraud, which adds another whole element to this. What she is alleged to have happened here is that Weinstein promised to put her in his movies, and he never did, and basically made a false representation to her, which constitutes a fraud. But that opens up a whole other can of worms, if you will, about, you know, people lying in the sexual context. I'm told that people do that. That people say, I promise I'll marry you. I love you. You're the only one. I'm not married. Whatever it is, the misrepresentations that people make in the sexual context, all of those are fraudulent and could potentially be covered by this statute.
Vince Finaldi, go right ahead.
I think something that needs to be pointed out is the fact that he didn't just sit there and say, hey, you know, I'm going to put you in the movie, and why don't you do this sex act? You know, as alleged, he went up behind her there in a secluded area. He put his hands on her shoulder. He's gripping her shoulders. This is a big man, a hulking man, much bigger than she is. He's telling her to relax. He's moving his hands down to her breast, grabbing her breasts. And so, you know, I think any reasonable person could understand how a woman in that position would be coerced and would be in fear for what this man would be doing to her. To say that that's consenting to it and that's some type of an arm's length transaction that she agreed to as a sex act is just absurd. I would be hard pressed to find any jurisdiction in the United States that would prosecute that for prostitution or something, you know, of that nature.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's at least for me, and maybe it's just because I just am legally ignorant, but that's to me what's a little unclear is what she is alleging is a very serious event that happened, and to then put it in the context of commercial sex, that's what I find a little bit confusion, because it would seem the legal action could be based on the very alleged behavior that you're describing.
Yeah, I think, you know, the distinction here, she's not suing because he didn't put her in a movie. She's suing him because he sexually assaulted her. Okay, the sex trafficking occurred when he engaged in that sexual act with her without her consent. That's something that takes place irrespective of whether she got a financial benefit or not. If he offered the financial benefit, they got him on the sex trafficking. I think this whole prostitution, you know.
Hold on, Stuart Green. Go ahead.
All right.
Yeah, Stuart Green, go right ahead now.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I agree with Vince 100%. I mean, this is a horrible case. If what she alleged happened, it's, you know, I say prosecute him to the full extent of the law for sexual assault. But this statute isn't about consent. This statute is about essentially prostitution, and that's the problem I have with it. It's not that Weinstein doesn't deserve, you know, to be, you know, prosecuted and
it's not about prostitution. Prostitution is a knowing and a willing thing. This is about involuntary servitude. This is someone who's being trafficked for sexual, so I don't agree that it's a voluntary thing. It doesn't really deal with that.
Okay, hold on, because I want to bring listeners into our conversation to get a sense, particularly those of you that work in Hollywood, and probably high percentage of people who've worked in Hollywood have in some way had occasion to come across the casting couch, whether it's in acting roles or in other jobs, that they have seen quid pro quo for sex. They have seen coercion involved. Do you think that a civil suit like this, under the specifics of sexual trafficking laws, coupled with the Me Too movement and those that are victimized coming forward, do you think this is going to make a change in the culture, or is it making a change? We're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Do you see a change occurring in the entertainment industry? And what are your thoughts also on the legal issues that are raised by the judge's decision in one of the civil suits against Harvey Weinstein? You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Coming up on Air Talk, Crazy Rich Asians, the new film that opens today, has many Asian Angelenos particularly excited about a film with an all-Asian cast, a major studio film, big budget by romantic comedy standards, and one that many are hopeful will open up the doors for many more Asian actors, crew members, writers, others to be able to work in the film industry and to see more of Asian cultural experiences depicted on screen. We're going to talk about the effect of the film coming up a little bit. Right now, our phone lines are open for you at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. A plaintiff who has filed a civil lawsuit against Harvey Weinstein has filed the suit, at least in part, under a provision of federal law that involves commercial sex trafficking. And a judge in New York, federal court judge, is allowing the case to proceed on those terms. So the question is, with it proceeding on those terms, what are the potential legal implications of that, taking an incident where it is alleged that there was coercive, abusive sexual activity and putting that within the framework of commercial sex? We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Stuart Green, Rutgers University Distinguished Professor of Law, I want to come back to you. If she ends up prevailing under these terms, the claim that this violated federal law, do you think that this particular statute will be more often used in civil lawsuits with similar kinds of allegations?
Well, sure. Why not? I mean, you know, criminal statutes are prosecuted by state prosecutors. Civil statutes like this are litigated by private plaintiffs. So private plaintiffs don't have the same kind of constraints that public prosecutors have. And basically, people can bring private lawsuits, sometimes even nuisance lawsuits, hoping for a settlement. I think if this door is opened up, you know, you could conceivably see a federal sex trafficking claim in all kinds of cases that previously would have been perhaps sexual harassment or a claim brought to the EEOC. I mean, there are any number of different circumstances in which it could be brought. So plaintiff's attorneys watch the dockets carefully, and if they see that this a case like this goes forward, that gives them the green light, I think, to push the limits. That's what plaintiff's attorneys do. They push the limits of the law to see how far it can go.
Terrence in Pasadena, you're on Air Talk.
Hey, so pretty much what I've seen, I've worked in the film industry for a little over 10 years now, and overall there's just an air of unprofessionalism. And that's not to take away from people that do great work every day and make great projects completely professionally, but there's this vibe of like, you know, this is fun, this is a cool job, this isn't, you know, I'm not working in the office. And I've worked primarily like more like in B-level films where there's like people from other industries that come in and invest money, and a lot of people are kind of buying their director's chair. So they come in, they have all this money from other industries, maybe they're dentists, maybe they're doctors, maybe this whatever. And then you have like these 18, 22, 25-year-old girls that come to L.A. wanting to be, you know, wanting to pursue their career, and they're broke. They don't have a lot of money. They're in a disadvantage. And I've been on multiple film sets where at the end of the day, oh, great, everyone, we had a great time. That was awesome. All right, hey, you guys want to come back to the party or whatever? And, you know, the grips aren't getting invited. Like, it's pretty much the young, hot girls. And they're put in this position where, you know, it's just, I'm sure it's not comfortable for them. I'm sure it's almost just the culture in and of itself breeds this scenario.
Yeah. And do you think, though, that given the current environment, that's going to be less likely to happen?
Well, I've seen people, you know, Me Too is something that people are talking about, people hashtag. But at the end of the day, you know, there are stronger forces at play. And it is a change. There is a movement. But it needs more attention, if anything, to kind of build, take the momentum. Because really, when you're broke and people have money and they're like, hey, I'll be your friend. I'll be cool with you. Come over, hang out with me. Come hang out with my cool friends.
Yeah.
That is more powerful than, you know, like talking. There just needs to be more talk.
Terrence, I appreciate your observations. Thank you so much. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Vince Finaldi, partner at Manley Stewart and Finaldi, do you think that these kinds of scenarios that were just described by Terrence are going to be less likely to happen in Hollywood?
Well, you know, in order for them to be less likely to happen, I do think that they should be less likely. People should get places on their merits, not because they were coerced into something by some perverted executive with a lot of money that wants to take advantage of a young girl who wants to further her career. And, you know, getting back to the point of Mr. Green, he said, you know, plaintiff's lawyers are going to, you know, essentially seek a buck and they're always looking to push the limits of the law. Well, you know what? That's how we get change done. You know, one way we get change is from people speaking up. Another way we get change is by using the law to make change. And if companies and people are held accountable for their actions through things such as this, then that's how we get change. You know, but these executives are not going to change on their own. It's been happening for years and years.
Well, it goes back from the earliest days of the film industry. This behavior has been embedded in it.
At one point in time, we had slavery in the U.S. That didn't make it right. You know, something had to be done to change it. Something has to be done to change this culture in that entertainment industry. And if it has to be done through enforcing sexual trafficking laws, then so be it. Because if kids and vulnerable adults are protected, we're all for it. And that's what plaintiff lawyers are here for. It's not just all about dollars. It's about...
Yeah. Vince, in fairness to Stewart, I didn't get the sense he was impugning plaintiff's attorneys. I thought his point was this is their job to try and push as far as they possibly can under the law. Professor Green, you want to respond?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, on balance, the Me Too movement is, you know, salutary movement in the United States. I think the problem of sexual misconduct is much, much broader than just Hollywood and media circles. This is what we read about mainly in the paper, but it occurs at every level of, you know, the American economy. So I'm all in favor of, you know, aggressive prosecution of sexual assault and rape laws. I'm in favor of aggressive enforcement of sexual harassment laws. And you know, I'm to some extent, I'm in favor of the Me Too process, although I think that sometimes it gets out of hand. But my only argument here is just that this particular statute that we're discussing, you know, how that fits into the broader context of Me Too and the problem of you know, sexual misconduct by men against women in the workplace in the United States, that's not the right way to approach it in general. And, you know, I don't know much about Hollywood, but, you know, my sense is that this kind of behavior, is endemic to the industry. And I think that's very sad. And I hope that era is, you know, is coming to an end. I think that a lot of powerful people in Hollywood probably will think, much more carefully before they engage in this kind of behavior. But I think that's because of the more general Me Too kind of phenomenon and movement that we're seeing, rather than the use of an overly broad, you know, federal sex trafficking statute, which was never designed for this kind of case, and probably Should be construed more narrowly. That's really what I'm trying to say.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both for being with us. Stuart Green, Rutgers University School of Law professor, Vince Finaldi, whose firm, Manley Stewart & Finaldi, has represented victims of sexual abuse in California. You can share your comments about the federal judge's decision yesterday allowing the case against Harvey Weinstein to proceed under terms of federal commercial sex trafficking laws. Coming up momentarily, the release today of Crazy Rich Asians, big studio film with an all-Asian cast. We'll talk about expectations within the Asian American communities of Southern California back in a minute. Senior media analyst at ComScore, Paul DeGarabedian, with us again to talk about the importance of box office to Hollywood, particularly when a major studio is involved. That's the case with Crazy Rich Asians, eagerly anticipated film, particularly by Asian Angelenos. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So, Paul, give us a sense. What is the projected box office for this film, and how does it compare with other major studio romantic comedies?
Well, you know, the movie opens today, Wednesday, and it goes. So we'll look at the 5-day Wednesday through Sunday. The expectations are around 25 to 30 million for the 5 days. It could go higher. All the buzz is really strong on the film. Early indications that, you know, who knows, maybe by the time we get to Friday and people have been hearing about the film Wednesday and Thursday, I think Warner Brothers is making a good call there to let some buzz build on the film before the weekend. I think this could be the movie that brings the rom-com back to life. We haven't really had a $100 million rom-com since Trainwreck 3 years ago, and you have to go back further than that to find a PG-13 romantic comedy with The Proposal back in 2009. I mean, it's been a pretty long dry spell for the genre itself. And so Crazy Rich Asians, a lot riding on this because of the all-Asian cast or predominantly Asian cast. But also, this could be the film to bring back the rom-com.
Paul, what is the release pattern here for Warners? Are they opening this wide across the country, including markets that have smaller populations of Asian Americans? Are they counting that there'll be significant non-Asian viewership of the film?
Absolutely. I mean, this film is opening not in 500 theaters, not 1,000 theaters, over 3,000 theaters. I think over 3,200 theaters. That's a nationwide break, as we call it. And that means Warners is looking at this as a film that has universal themes, that can appeal to everyone, and that's how they're going to get that long-term playability, get a great opening weekend, get the buzz building on social media. And because the movie is so good, from all indications, that will get the message out even more. If the movie wasn't good and it didn't play well, it didn't open to solid numbers, then the message would be lost in that. So I think this is going to be a really important movie, both for the genre, for the furthering of films with diverse casts. And that's been proving to be a good bet for Hollywood, good business to be in the inclusion and diversity business. And it's paid off well this year and this summer and even last year as well. It's been a long time coming, but we're seeing more movies that offer up diverse points of view, casts, different backgrounds and stories, but also have universal appeal to everyone.
Yeah, I mean, Black Panther, which had almost full African-American cast, that film, of course, did huge numbers across the country, and that wasn't marketed as an African-American film. Paul, we're going to continue. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. And I particularly like to hear from Asian Angelenos. Have you seen the film in a special screening? Are you planning to go see the movie tonight or within the next few days? And what is, for you, the importance of this film as a potential door opener for additional films with Asian casts and dealing with different Asian cultural facets? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Crazy Rich Asians, released today. Major studio romantic comedy with an almost all Asian cast. And it's been eagerly anticipated by many Asian Angelenos, hopeful that Chinese cultural depictions, the settings in Singapore and Malaysia, and the casting of the film will open up the door to much more representation of Asians on film. I welcome your calls if you are Asian American, you're planning to see the film, or maybe you've seen it in a special screening. I welcome your thoughts about what you think the significance of this film is. We're at 866-893-KPECC. That's 866-893-5722. Of course, it's, you know, by no means the first film with a dominant Asian cast. Justin Lin's Better Luck Tomorrow, The Joy Luck Club, The Wedding Banquet. Those are just three of the films that have had almost all Asian casts or that have been specific Asian cultural references at the center. But obviously it's a handful of films we're talking about, very small number comparative to the population of Asian Americans. 866-893-KPECC. Or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with us is CNN contributor of co-host of the podcast about the Asian American experience. They call us Bruce. Jeff Yang. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you.
So you were kind of an unofficial consultant on the movie. What was some of the advice you offered?
Well, to the credit of WP, they reached out early on, understanding that they had a very unique I wouldn't say problem, but opportunity on their hands as far as really understanding how to make a film that has an all Asian cast, work for a community that is both hungry for it, but also skeptical, right? So they reach out early to people they saw as influencers or leaders in the community to get their insights. And, you know, we all watched the film, and afterwards, I had a kind of an instant response, which was they needed to get this film into the community out often and as broadly as possible. There's a line in the film early on in which Rachel Chu, the protagonist of the film, who's an economics professor, basically says, you know, the difference in success is whether you're playing to win or playing not to lose. And I said, you've got something here that if you're a believer in it, and you should be playing to win and not to lose. Screen it everywhere. Get everybody to evangelize it. Make sure that people understand how transformative this moment is.
Well, the risk in that, though, isn't it that many in your core audience then will have seen it for free?
Yes, but that's the difference between playing not to lose and playing to win. You might lose out on 100 tickets or, you know, 1,000 tickets or even 10,000 tickets. I mean, hopefully not that number because people have seen free screenings. But I'm seeing the film for the fifth time tonight, and I've organized, at this point, four buyout screenings for other people to see it. And I'm not alone. There's this hashtag right now, Gold Open, GOLDOPEN, where Asian Americans across America are doing their best to not just evangelize the film, but actually buy tickets for people who can't afford them because they see this as such a significant moment in our cultural history. And so that's the kind of activation that Crazy Rich Asians and, you know, other films like Black Panther before it have understood or is sort of necessary to get people to understand how much of a break with Hollywood past these films represent.
I was wondering, Jeff, for an Asian Angelina who goes to a screening, sees the film, doesn't really like it, if it's hard to talk about and say, well, you know, I'm glad they're making a film with a almost exclusively Asian cast, but I didn't care for it. Are people going to be, if they didn't like it, kind of be afraid to talk about that?
You know, from my experience, people are not afraid in this day and age to share when they have concerns or critique around stuff. I mean, all you have to do is look at social media.
Yeah, but no, but this has almost become a cause, the film. So it's not like criticizing, you know, a standard movie.
Yes, and that's absolutely true. And maybe there's a little bit of pressure around that. But I think that one of the things that we have seen is there's absolutely realm to talk about the things the film doesn't do. The interesting thing here is when you see a film, let's say, that has a predominantly white cast, people don't see that as representing the community. They don't say, if this film lives and dies, there will never be, you know, for the next 25 years, another film with a mostly all-white cast. But at the same time, people don't assume that that film has to carry the burdens of representation of an entire, if you will, European-American community. So, you know, what I think that people are contending with here is, even if it's not perfect, we need to make sure the door is held open and that opportunity continues.
We're talking with Jeff Yang, who co-hosts the podcast They Call Us Bruce. It focuses on the Asian American experience. He's also a CNN contributor, and he was one of the community influencers who worked with Warner Brothers, provided his feedback on his advice for how to raise the profile of the film within the Asian American communities across the country. I welcome your calls if you are Asian American and this film is particularly meaningful to you. Maybe you haven't had a chance to see it yet. But just I welcome hearing your anticipation for the film, hopes or concerns that you have. If you have seen it in one of the special screenings, I'd be interested in your thoughts and how you think it's going to play. Let's talk with Kina in the city of Orange. You're on Air Talk.
Hi. You know, as a Chinese Singaporean American, it was incredibly cool not just to read the book but to see the movie and see Asians represented on screen. But I think what's really important about this movie is that they don't say this is a movie just for Asians. This is a movie that's a romantic comedy that happens to feature Asians and opens the door for representation in other movies that are for everybody.
And Kina, did you go to one of these special screenings to where pretty much everybody there was Asian American?
No, you know, they did a open release on the 8th, so I bought a row of tickets. I brought a bunch of my friends. Some of them were Asian, some of them weren't. And then I'm actually going to go again tonight, and we're doing the same thing.
Wow. So how many times, I mean, if you had to guess, how many times do you think you're going to go buy a ticket, pay to see the film?
I will probably see the movie 5 times. I'll buy the DVD. I'll ship it to my grandma in Singapore and show all of my family. So probably many times.
Wow. And so you mentioned family. So this is a multi-generational experience?
For me, it is. My mom is from Singapore. My grandma's from Malaysia. A lot of the actors are Singaporean and Malaysian. And it's really important for us to be able to, you know, see a movie where we're represented. Even when, you know, Trump was just recently in Singapore, people, even the newscasters, didn't even realize Singapore is its own country. And so it's crazy to be able to see the country and Singapore and Malaysia represented in a huge movie.
Kina, thank you so much for your call. Really appreciate it. So many times buying a ticket to see the film, Kina in Orange. Let me go back to Paul Daragabedian, senior media analyst for ComScore. Paul, is a lot of the projection here for the box office based on multiple tickets sold, kind of like we see with the blockbuster films?
Yeah, I mean, that often comes into play. And particularly with this film, when you have a Wednesday opening and you have that first 5 days, so it's almost like an extended weekend, I think we're going to see a really strong outpouring of support for the movie. And then, you know, people will go see it with their family or just by themselves or with one other person, then take other people back to see it. That's the best thing about a great movie. You just want to take other people and as Jeff said earlier, evangelize, you know, get the word out about the film. And I think what Kina said was also really important is that this is a movie just aimed at the Asian American community, even though it's incredibly important in that way. But the universal themes, I mean, interacting with your mother-in-law, I mean, you know, who among us hasn't done that or gone to a wedding or had familial dynamics that are very interesting, to say the least, all that comes into play. And also the fact that the filmmakers, they said to Netflix, Netflix offered them a huge deal. And they said, no, we want to go theatrical. We want to be in the movie theater. You know, that's where you get that groundswell within the zeitgeist, rather than going on streaming and being lost amidst a huge amount of content. The filmmakers went for it. And I love that. And that just means they're really behind the film and they understand the importance in this day and age with all this technology of sitting in a theater in that communal and immersive environment of the movie theater. And I think that's going to play very well in terms of crazy rich Asians.
Paul, I know you got to run, but real quickly, what number do you think the film has got to do to really send a message to major studios that they need to be thinking more about films with dominant Asian American or Asian casts?
Well, I think it's not just about the opening weekend, although that's important. But, certainly if it does 25 to 30 million for the 5 days, that's a great number. If it continues to play well into September, then who knows? I think anything over 60, 70, 80 million is an absolute slam dunk. If it were to get to 100 million, that's just, wonderful. And I'm just talking about in North America. Worldwide, it remains to be seen. I think that could be a really strong play for the film in terms of the worldwide global box office. And I think that will bode well for this film and for films like it with Asian casts going forward. These are films that are breaking down barriers, and that is a really good thing.
All right, Paul, thanks so much. Really appreciate your being with us. Sure. Paul Daragabedian of ComScore. We'll continue with Jeff Yang of the podcast They Call Us Bruce, CNN contributor, Crazy Rich Asians, the movie we're talking about, adapted from the book of the same name, the film opening today. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in just a minute. We're in the midst of what's predicted to be the fourth hottest year on record. Terry Gross on Fresh Air talks with Somini Sengupta, New York Times international climate reporter, about rising temperatures and what some of the implications are in places around the world. That's Fresh Air with Terry Gross, just a few minutes away here on 89.3 KPCC. Right now, we're looking at Crazy Rich Asians, a much-anticipated film, particularly in Asian American communities of Southern California. And I'd love to hear from you if you are an Asian Angeleno, you've seen the film at this point, or you're planning to see it, what the significance of the film is for you. 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Jeff, I was wondering about why this film is getting so much more play than even The Joy Luck Club or Better Luck Tomorrow or Ang Lee's The Wedding Banquet. Films that have touched on or immersed themselves in Asian American or Asian culture?
Well, first of all, times have changed. I mean, 25 years since The Joy Luck Club have seen the rise of social media, the rise of the actual demographic of Asians in the United States in ways that I think even could not have been predicted back in 1993. I mean, we are the fastest growing population in the United States. We actually are per capita the largest purchasers of movie tickets in theaters. We're kind of neck and neck with Hispanics. So, all that added to the fact that we punch above our weight on social media means that, for a population that is approximately, 5, 6, 7% of the United States, depending on who you're looking at, we actually have a disproportionate impact on culture. And it also means that when there's something happening, we, as a community of Asian Americans, are more likely to be able to turn it into a viral happening, if you will, because of those factors, than virtually any other demographic in the United States. So we're able to make noise, and we're able to actually turn moments into movements. That is something that couldn't really have been leveraged in 93 or in the early 2000s, but it's certainly something that Crazy Rich Asians is leveraging now, and something that we told them they needed to leverage.
We had the listener, Keena, from the city of Orange, who called. I think she said she was going to pay for a ticket probably five times and then buy the Blu-ray and other stuff. How many times do you think you're going to end up seeing it?
I'm seeing it for the fifth time tonight.
Fifth time.
And I've already, much as your other listener mentioned, I've already told my parents how many times they're going to be seeing it. I bought tickets for my sister who lives in Connecticut. I am actively already preparing people on the other side of the planet, in Taiwan and in China, friends of mine who are eagerly waiting this film to go, as it were, international, for what they're looking to expect as well. This is something which it's, I think, the first time I've seen this happen in our community. People are understanding that it's not just about representation alone, right? You know, there have been other programs out there, other films and television shows that have featured Asian Americans. But when you have a product that's representative and also entertaining, that's also high quality, that's also deeply meaningful, that makes all the difference in the world. And I kind of know that a little firsthand as well, because I happen to be connected to another program that kind of turned into a phenomenon. My son, Hudson Yang, is on the ABC television show Fresh Off the
Boat. Yeah, yeah.
And we,
so you've seen this very close to home.
Yeah, that groundswell, when it occurs, it's transformative.
Let's talk with Hannah in the West Adams District. Hannah, briefly, your thoughts about the significance of Crazy Rich Asians.
Hi, yes, Larry. So I should disclose that I work for Senator Mitchell, who wrote SB 951, which includes a diversity kind of waiver into the film and tax credit for California. But as an Asian American who grew up in the 90s, this is the first time that we have a film where it includes Asian Americans and not Asians, because there's a big difference. And I don't think folks know kind of the nuances and the differences in the diaspora of the Asian American community. So that representation, with it being more widely kind of understood about the diversity issues with, you know, social media and such, I think that's going to be important for people to have that representation, but it to have some sort of ramifications that kind of sustain it for future films, and to show that this is kind of a thing that's not only about it being an Asian story, but about an American story.
Very good. You also wanted to raise the issue about how Asian characters have often been cast with non-Asian actors?
Yes, definitely. I think if we look at Scarlett Johansson and Emma Stone, and then also things like The Great Wall of China, with including, you know, white characters like Matt Damon, you know, I think it's important. And I think some of this awareness is important, as and it has effects, because if we look at Hellboy, you know, Daniel Day Kim was stepped into the role only because the actor, and his name eludes me right now, he stepped down and said that, you know, morally and his value system wise, that this role should go to an Asian American and not towards someone who's not. And so I think that, you know, the ripples are just starting to happen, and it's going to be exciting to see, you know, how far they really go.
All right. Appreciate it, Hannah, in the West Adams District. Thank you very much for joining us. Susan Hirasuna, Fox 11 here in L.A., tweets at Air Talk. I was with my newborn when I went to see the Joy Luck Club. He's turning 25 Thursday. It's about time. There's a major studio released with a predominantly Asian cast. Saw it, loved it, taking the rest of my family ASAP. That's Susan Hirasuna of Fox 11 News. Nice to have her tweeting at Air Talk. And my thanks to CNN contributor Jeff Yang, co-host of the podcast They Call Us Bruce, which focuses on the Asian American experience. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up next. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk. It's here every weekday, 10 to noon on 89.3 KPCC.